And I guess he must have been in a coma and thought the year was 2016 because he started demanding Hillary's emails and for the feds to arrest Obama. And then he released this series of odd videos from the White House that started like this.
Perhaps you recognize me. It's your favorite president.
Actually, I barely recognize you because your makeup artist seems to have given you the Dolezal.
President Trump claimed to have survived the coronavirus. Yay. I'm not going to say I'm disappointed, but it kind of feels like when there's a car crash and the only survivor is the drunk driver. Trump's... Trump said him getting COVID was, quote, a blessing from God. And I bet even God was like, hey, we tried, guys. Actually, maybe we should be more optimistic about this. I mean, there's two ways we can look at it. Either Trump's telling the truth and we finally have a cure for COVID, or Trump is lying and he's still gonna die. I'm not gonna say that's a win-win, but it's definitely not a lose-lose. No?
I also have to say, it's amazing to watch a guy have a near-death experience and learn nothing from it. It's like watching someone smoke through the hole in their neck. In fact, Trump is now trying to convince Americans that COVID actually makes you stronger and that it made him feel better than he did 20 years ago. So he went from COVID is a hoax to COVID will disappear one day like a miracle. And now he's like, actually, COVID is the miracle. And it was inside of us all along. But hey, if getting COVID is good, then his supporters are in luck, because this was him at a rally last week when he had corona. Come on, look at him. He's like an evil Oprah. You're getting COVID. You're getting COVID. You're getting COVID. And look under your seats. It's a ventilator.
It was a dark show. President Trump said that a therapeutic drug from Regeneron, which is derived from stem cells, is a cure for COVID, which seems unlikely, unfounded, irresponsible, and I can't wait to buy 1,000 shares of Regeneron baby juice stock.
The corona pandemic continues to rage in America's hot zone, 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue. With COVID running rampant throughout the executive branch, this morning the Commission on Presidential Debates announced that the second presidential debate will be virtual. The decision did not sit well with Trump's campaign manager, Bill Stepien, who, by the way, also has the COVID. Stepien claimed the new format is unnecessary because Trump will have posted multiple negative tests prior to the debate. That's not how any of this works. You can't put all your faith in something that might happen down the line when the potential consequence is death. So, what will this virtual debate look like? We might never find out, because after it was announced, Trump immediately called Maria Bartiromo of Fox Business and said this.
I'm not going to do a virtual debate. I'm not going to waste my time on a virtual debate.
This is your president just taking a little morning nap before I start my presidential day at 11:30 a.m. sharp. As you can tell, I'm breathing so strongly and recovering so powerfully. Okay, the news media, the fake news, they don't want you to know this. And they're so upset that our great Vice President Mike Pence had a great debate last night. Did you see that? He was fighting two blacks, Kokomo Harris, and that aggressive African-American fly that landed on his head and tried to assault him. And Mike Pence, I tell you, he was a lot more Christian than I would have been. I would have whacked the crap out of that fly, but he just let it sit there humping his head because he's a great Christian, and, you know, I'd say more peaceful than me. I would be more of a get the hell out of here fly, but our great Vice President didn't do that. But he had such a strong debate, and now do you see what they did today? The Committee on Cock Debates got me so upset. They said they want me to do a virtual debate next week. I'm not doing a virtual debate. Everybody wants to do Zoom. Okay, remember Skype? We used to have Skype, and then all of a sudden COVID hit, and then Zoom showed up. So I'm announcing today that Bill Barr, great attorney general, will be investigating Zoom to see if they're the ones that started the COVID, okay? And I don't like Zoom, okay? Not a lot of people remember this, but in the 90s, there was a video. They called themselves Rex in Effects, okay? Not too nice. And they zoom-a-zoom-zoomed in a boom-boom, and it was African-Americans going crazy on a beach with saxophones and thongs and... It was not too nice, okay? Very scary. I would have to change the channel whenever that video came on. So we're not doing a virtual debate. I know Sleepy Joe would like a virtual debate, but we're not doing it. We're not going to do it, okay? I'm not a webcam girl president, okay? We're not doing webcam, okay? My fans like it when I spit COVID on them. We call it the money shot, okay? They're always like, give me more, Mr. President. We can't deny them that. But for more web girl content, check out Melatonin's OnlyFans.
You say you feel great, but the media is out there saying, well, you're contagious. Do you feel that you are? I mean, obviously, you
no, wouldn't I don't think I'm
feel
contagious,
that way if
but
you're
we
saying
still have
you're
to
ready to go to a rally.
I don't think I'm contagious at all.
Tested very soon,
but I'm essentially very clean. They say it's over a period of 6-7 days, and it was an amazing thing happened to me. I just went in and I didn't feel good, and that's okay. I expect it at some point because I'm out there. I've got to be a leader. I can't, you know, Winston Churchill didn't sit in his basement for 6 months. I call them cures. I don't call them therapeutics. You take it. It's an antibody drug. You take it, and it beats the hell out of it. And I'm telling you, I could have walked out there 24 hours after I went in. I didn't even have to go in, frankly. I think it would have gone away by itself. You know, it's great. And what I'm doing is I'm going to supply this drug. It made me better, I will tell you right now. I walked in. I didn't feel great. I think I would have done it fine without drugs. You know, you don't really need drugs. I've stopped. I don't take them anymore. No, I don't take them anymore.
Okay.
I think I'm taking almost nothing.
So these drugs are great, but he doesn't need them. But they cured him right away, and he's going to fast-track them. But he would have been fine without them, so he's not taking them. Why is it that he took the experimental drug, and we're the ones experiencing dizziness, confusion, and nausea?
This week, our addled president has been sitting around in a mostly deserted White House infectious zone, watching TV and angrily scream-tweeting at all hours of the night. The place is turning into Grey Gardens. If Trump gets reelected, he's going to be holed up in there with long hair and fingernails while flies buzz around Mike Pence's head. Trump's apparently just been watching TV and stewing as the White House COVID outbreak spirals further out of control, and his poll numbers continue to tank with less than 4 weeks until the election. And plus, he's been on a combination of powerful steroids and experimental drugs while frying his brain with hours of cable news. So exactly what you want from the guy in charge of the nuclear arsenal. They're going to have to keep that briefcase away from him the way you hide a tennis ball from a dog.
One of Trump's military aides tasked with carrying the nuclear football reportedly has the coronavirus.
The rivers are full of ballots. Mailmen have been indicted. Tiny dust particles are everywhere. Everyone is contagious except for me, your hero, the perfect physical specimen. Trump has concocted an elaborate fantasy in which his political opponents committed treason against him and has called for his predecessor, his previous opponent, and his current opponent to all be prosecuted in jail. This is how erratic and unstable our political system has been under Trump and the GOP. In fact, today the president released yet another one of his bizarre Twitter videos where he stands outside the White House and rambles in a way that would make you think the drugs are kicking in, except, you know, he's Donald Trump. Here he is addressing seniors.
You're not vulnerable, but they like to say the vulnerable, but you're the least vulnerable. But for this one thing, you are vulnerable.
Oh, thanks for clearing it up. So, I'm sorry, are they vulnerable or not?
They say you're vulnerable, but you're not. But for this, you are. Even though in general, you're not. You're invulnerable. To me, vulnerable, which means you're not vulnerable, unless you're vulnerable.
It's like an ancient riddle scrawled on an Egyptian cave. So the Trump White House is a pandemic hot zone. Staffers and journalists are either quarantined or working from home. And the ones who are there have to wear gowns, masks, and eye covers. Right now, the White House is more deserted than a CVS at midnight. Every day, it seems the number of people connected to the White House cluster who test positive for coronavirus grows. And now, even the agency in charge of federal disaster response is getting involved.
This morning, the coronavirus outbreak on the grounds of the White House even worse than the Trump administration has admitted. ABC News obtained an internal memo sent Wednesday to top officials at FEMA listing the total number of infected White House staffers and other contacts at 34. That's 10 more than had been previously known.
That's right. FEMA is writing memos about the White House now. I know there's a lot about the Trump era that's on the nose, but even I never imagined the White House would become a literal disaster zone. Soon we're going to see Trump sleeping on a cot in a high school gymnasium. He's going to film his next Everything is Going Great video wrapped in a tinfoil blanket, eating beans from a can with a plastic spoon.
We beat it, folks. Corona's on the run, and I think we can all agree that is cool beans.
And think about how crazy that is. At least 34 people have now been infected with the coronavirus. And it's not just the staffers inside the White House or Trump's inner circle. A shocking report published yesterday by USA Today found that the White House coronavirus outbreak may have exposed thousands of people across multiple states. He's Typhoid Mary if she held rallies. Of course, it seems like this can all be traced back to what appears to have been a super spreader event at the White House last month to introduce Trump's nominee for the Supreme Court, Amy Coney Barrett. And this whole episode has been a perfect encapsulation of the criminal negligence, ineptitude, secrecy, and recklessness with which the Trump administration has handled the pandemic as a whole. For one thing, people were hugging and talking in close proximity to each other, and they even held indoor events without masks or social distancing. It's not just your own health. You're putting others at risk. Engaging in this kind of behavior during a pandemic is like slathering yourself in honey and whacking a hornet's nest with a baseball bat, which I guess would explain why Trump's face always looks like he just pulled it out of a beehive.
What could I say? Daddy's got a sweet tooth.
And by the way, the only reason they rushed to hold this super spreader gala in the first place was so they could pack the court with a 6-3 supermajority before an election. Trump is actively trying to undermine and to rule on a case in November in which the Trump administration is suing to destroy Obamacare and rip health care away from 20 million, including those with pre-existing conditions. And in doing so, they ended up getting themselves sick. Ever since his positive test, Trump has been telling people not to be afraid of COVID and that we shouldn't let it dominate our lives, which, of course, is easy for him to say since he lives in a mansion with an in-house clinic and was literally flown by helicopter to a premier medical institution where he received the best taxpayer-funded health care in the world. Trump hates universal single-payer health care until he needs it. Then he turns into a socialist. He's going to show up to his next press conference in a headband and Karl Marx t-shirt shouting,
"We must pass Medicare for all who are named Donald Trump."
In fact, the New York Times did the math and estimated that Trump's care would have cost the average American $100,000. And something tells me you still wouldn't hit your out-of-pocket limit. And, of course, it's an especially sweet deal for Trump, given that in 2016 and 17, he paid only $750 in federal income taxes per year. If Trump loses in November, it would be great if Biden sent him a bill for $99,250 just to watch him sweat.
I'll get you the money, Joe, I swear. I just need one more hit of dexamethasone. Daddy's got to get his dex on. Got to get on that highway to dexamethasone.
Just quickly take stock of where we're at right now. The cases are once again on the rise while just three states report declines. The president's tweeted that he was unilaterally ending stimulus talks, then reversed himself. Some of the country's senior military leadership, including members of the Joint Chiefs, are in quarantines. Raccoons have taken over the White House, and staffers have to wear masks, gowns, and face shields to enter the Oval Office like they're performing an alien autopsy at Area 51. Or as the president put it,
"We have enthusiasm like probably nobody's ever had. Our people that love the job we're doing, we have more enthusiasm than maybe anybody."
So much enthusiasm. I guess you could say it's contagious. We're spreading it across the country. Everyone's got it, and they're giving it to their neighbors.
Faster than a speeding bullet. More powerful than a locomotive. Able to leap tall buildings at a single bound.
Look. Up in the sky. It's a bird.
It's a plane.
It's Donald Trump.
Our contaminator-in-chief was in Florida tonight. He had a big maskless rally. He says the doctors gave him the okay to do it. That's good news, though. It'll be nice to get back to having a president who's only mentally ill. Trump was on the Tucker Carlson show on Friday night for what they were billing as a virtual medical exam. It was not that, but the president did treat the Friday night Fox crowd to a brief guided tour of his body.
Where do you think you got the virus? At what point do you think you contracted it, looking back?
You know, I don't know. They had some big events at the White House, and perhaps there. I don't really know. Nobody really knows for sure. Numerous people have contracted it. But, you know, people have contracted it all over the world. It's highly contagious. That's one thing you learn. This is a contagious disease.
That is one thing you learn about this contagious disease, is that it's contagious. You know, the president's been very cagey about whether he's tested negative yet, but whether he's negative or not, it doesn't matter because his new thing is he's got immunity. For Donald Trump, herd immunity means he heard someone on Twitter say he was immune. folks at Twitter flagged this tweet. Trump posted a total and complete sign-off from White House doctors yesterday. That means I can't get it, immune, and can't give it. Very nice to know. Very nice, yes. Can't get it and can't give it is also the arrangement Melania has with the president. But that tweet got flagged for violating Twitter's rules against spreading misleading and potentially harmful information. But go on, Mr. President. Tell us more about how invincible you are.
I passed the highest test, the highest standards, and I'm in great shape. And I have to tell you, I feel fantastically. I really feel good. And I even feel good by the fact that, you know, the word immunity means something, having really a protective glow means something. I think it's very important to have that.
Yeah, it is very important. It's not a protective glow, though. That is Hawaiian Tropics mango-scented tanning mousse that you're seeing. If it sounds like Trump is trying to position himself as some kind of superhero now, listen to this. The failing New York Times reported that when he got out of the hospital last week, he wanted to put on a show. His plan, he floated this idea to several people, was to walk out of the hospital appearing to be frail, and then he would tear off his button-down shirt to reveal a Superman logo underneath. This is not a joke. This is what he wanted to do. Whoever talked him out of this, I'd like to bang you right on the head, because I mean, first of all, we've gotten to see some top-notch acting as when Trump was pretending to be frail. Then he would have had to rip the shirt open, and good luck getting those buttons undone with those nubby little baby carrot fingers he has. And then what would happen when he reveals the S on his chest? Would the country erupt in applause? What does he imagine? Most likely, he would try to fly and wet his pants or something. But who thinks like this? That's really steal the election is getting back on the road after Florida tonight. He's scheduled to host rallies in Pennsylvania and Iowa this week. He supposedly wants to be out on the campaign trail every day from now until November 3rd. He's desperate. He's trailing bigly in the polls, but he did pick up a major endorsement over the weekend from none other than the Taliban. That's right. A spokesman for the Taliban said, "We believe that Trump is going to win the upcoming election because he has proved himself a politician who accomplished all the major promises he had made to the American people, although he might have missed some small things, but did accomplish the bigger promises. So it is possible that the U.S. people who experienced deceptions in the past will once again trust Trump for his decisive actions." The Trump campaign rejected the endorsement from the Taliban. I wonder how that went down, though. You know, other than groups like Sheriffs for Shooting Looters and Mullets for Jesus, Trump doesn't get a lot of endorsements, and he also loves people who love him. It's really his only criteria. So when that endorsement from the Taliban came in, my guess is his campaign team was like, don't even tell him about it. Just reject it. Reject it. If he's mad, we will deal with this later. But on Saturday, Fatty LuPone gave another Evita-style performance from his balcony. He spoke to a group of mostly Black and Latino supporters who assembled hilariously on the White House lawn. They're part of a group called Blexit, which is supposed to be a group of Black people who support Trump. The truth is, these are people who were paid to be at the event. They had their travel expenses covered in exchange for showing up and putting on the T-shirt. Trump spoke only for 18 minutes, but he did make sure to bring up his favorite thing to say whenever he sees a Black person.
"The fact is that I've done more for the Black community than any president since Abraham Lincoln. I say it. Nobody can dispute it. Nobody can dispute it."
Nobody can. Everyone can dispute it. He does seem to believe that he's very popular with the Black community. On the campaign trail, in 2016, he said, "At the end of the four years, I guarantee you I will get over 95% of the African-American vote. I promise you." Well, we're at the end of those 4 years, and we wanted to put his guarantee to the test. So we sent a camera crew out on Hollywood Boulevard to poll African-American passers-by to see if we can find anyone who will be supporting Trump at the ballot box next month.
As a Black man, are you voting for Trump?
I absolutely am not.
Absolutely, I would not.
Hell no.
No.
Probably not. I can't vote for a racist.
Hell no.
Nah.
No, I'm not.
Am I voting for Trump?
Yeah.
Nah.
No, I'm not.
Hell no.
No, not at all.
Hell no.
No.
Absolutely not.
No, not voting for Trump.
Hell no.
No, I'm not voting for Trump.
Absolutely not.
Is that a baby?
Yeah, this is a baby.
And that baby with Trump, against Trump?
Against, definitely. Trump. I don't mess with Trump at all.
No.
No, I'm not voting for Trump.
No.
I ain't gonna vote for Trump.
No, I'm not voting for Trump.
Hell no, I ain't voting for that dude.
Are you crazy?
No.
Hell no.
He's not getting my vote, no.
Absolutely not.
No, sir.
Do you know any black people who are voting for Trump?
I don't know any.
You don't know any?
Not one person.
Not one
that's
person?
Black that's dead to
them. No co-workers?
No co-workers.
You got uncles and aunties saying they're going to vote for Trump?
No.
Mama voting for Trump?
No.
Daddy voting for Trump?
No.
Friends from church voting for Trump?
No, sir. I remember Trump and WWE. Yeah. To me, that's what he's still doing. He's still on The Apprentice. He's still listening to a reality show. He's still acting apart.
You can't pay me $1 million. I'm not voting for Trump.
Would you vote for Trump for $1 million?
No.
What about an Applebee's gift card?
No.
Free Wi-Fi?
Free Wi-Fi would be nice.
But no Wi-Fi. Cellular data, brother.
I absolutely do not believe he's going to get 95% of the vote because I don't know a black man or a black woman that is going to vote for Donald Trump. And I am immersed in black people.
You ain't got a single black
man. Not a dog, not a black cat, not a black dog, not a black pit bull is going to vote for Donald Trump.
Preceding show was recorded at Wavefarms WGXC in the Hudson Valley in New York State.
For some reason or another, you sound a little taller on radio.
So I assume you all missed the Sleepy Joe panel because you were watching me do very strong verbal diarrhea and powerful speech talking on NBC. I'm going to give you the quick minute summary of the Sleepy Joe town hall. So Sleepy Joe's first question is from, I guess, Sammy Sosa's trying to be black again. Now Sleepy Joe's talking to Khloe Kardashian if she'd never had any work done. Now Sleepy Joe's talking to a tough bald guy. That's my guy. We like those guys. And there he is with his little baby note card because he doesn't know what he's talking about. This guy is sweating more than Patrick Ewing. Get this African-American a towel, Joe. I would get it with Ice Cube. Well, she voted for me. She looks like a suburban housewife, but that Philadelphia accent is disgusting. Well, you know, this masked cuck is going to vote for Biden. He looks like Walter White. Well, this is a white-haired, strong white man. So why did he smile at Sleepy Joe? Don't smile at Sleepy Joe. You
gotta fight for your right to party. Gotta fight for your right to party.
You gotta
fight for your right to party.
And you don't wanna go, and you ask your mom please, but she still says no. You miss two classes and no homework, but your teacher preaches class like you're some kind of jerk. You gotta fight,
gotta fight for your right to party. Gotta fight for your right to party. Gotta fight for your right to party. Gotta fight for your right to party.
House, if that's the clothes you're gonna wear, I'll kick you out of my home if you don't cut that hair. Your mom busted in and said, what's that noise? Oh, mom, you're just jealous, it's the Beachy Boys.
You gotta fight, gotta fight for your right to party. Gotta fight for your right to party. Gotta fight for your right to party. Gotta fight for your right to party.
You gotta fight.
For your right to party, gotta fight for your right to party. 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 Gotta fight for your right to party.
So normally on this show, in pre and post COVID times, we would be taking the first portion of the show to talk about newly released movies. But Jenny, what have you been watching lately?
Well, I have. So, well, let me first bring back the Dispatch from the Woodstock Film Festival.
Yes.
Which was last 2 weeks ago. 2 weeks ago. Time is not real. I ended up going to two of the nights, which was really fun. I went on the opening night to see Los Hermanos, which was excellent. If you are interested in learning more about the Woodstock Film Festival, you can go back into the archives and listen to our interview with Mira Blaustein, which we did on our last show. But
she's the one of the directors and co-founders of the film festival.
Yeah. And then the other night I went on Friday, Los Hermanos was at the Greenville Drive-In. And then the Friday night I went to the Overlook Drive-In in Poughkeepsie and I saw What Breaks the Ice and Ammonite. And they were both fun.
Nice.
It didn't, you know, nothing really blew me out of the water. Los Hermanos was definitely the best of the three.
Can you give me like a little breakdown of all of them, like a little synopsis?
Yeah. So Los Hermanos was a documentary. Is a documentary that it was actually the world premiere of them showing it. Yeah, which is wild. But it follows these two brothers who were both born in Cuba, but the elder brother, when he was like 14, moved to the United States to pursue his music career. They're both musicians. They're both of their parents were musicians, so it's just like totally their whole passion and like their whole family's passion. Mm-hmm. But it kind of follows them in their relationship where for decades, like they're both in their 50s now, maybe, or 40s and 50s, they have been separated and they were not able to play together because the elder brother lives in the United States and the younger brother lives in Cuba. And there is like, yeah, it's just really beautiful. The music was incredible.
Wow.
I really liked it. It like made me laugh, made me cry. You know, your classic.
Yeah.
hit all the notes.
All the notes. What kind of instruments do they play?
The older brother plays the violin and the younger brother plays the piano. And they're both composers also. Like they're both incredible and like world-class musicians, like top of their game.
Wow.
But yeah, it was really lovely. And then the second film I watched was called What Breaks the Ice. And that one was a narrative film, it was basically about these two girls over, it was filmed in Cold Spring, which was fun because I was like,
nice.
local Hudson Valley.
love a
local movie, but it takes place in the 90s, which is also fun.
Mm-hmm.
And it's about two teenage girls, one who's a local, a townie, and then the other one who's like a summer kid from Manhattan, and like they like become super, super fast friends, and kind of just like all the events that transpire between them over the summer.
Mm-hmm.
And that one was really fun. It was, the thing about that night was I saw that movie and Ammonite at the same time, and they were both on like the darker side, like visually, not thematically.
Yeah, just the
just like they just both take place at night a lot, or like in candlelight.
Yeah.
And so seeing it at the drive-in was kind of tough because you just couldn't see the screen all the time.
I know that is the one downer.
Yeah, so I'd like to give them both another watch someday. And then Ammonite, do you want to talk about actually a little bit, because I know you haven't seen it, but you gave the summary for it last time and it was so great.
Oh, thanks. So I'm so curious about it, though. I know that it like, we had high expectations, I think, but
my review of it is that it was mediocre.
Yeah,
not
like
bad,
fine.
But just like fine.
It's fine.
The thing is that, and it's, you know, I talked about this in our very first show, so it's possible that you may not have heard my opinion about it, but one of the best movies, one of the best period romances between two women on a beach came out this year. It was called Portrait of a Lady on Fire. And you know, just nothing will ever measure up to that. Like, it's
now that you've been at the top, it's so hard. Everything's so hard.
Literally a perfect film. It's like one of the most romantic and beautiful things I've ever seen in my life.
Gosh.
And it's just like, you know, other films that are about lesbians by the seaside just don't stand a chance if they don't measure up.
They don't hold a candle. And I still freaking haven't seen
Ladies and gentlemen, you are listening to WGXC 90.7 FM, Accra.
Saturday, October 17th, tune in to all sorts of interesting live programming on WGXC. At 10:30, Joshua Freed remixes New York City Radio live on the radio in the Hudson Valley at 90.7 FM. 10:30 to 11 a.m. with the Radio Wonderland show. At 1 p.m., we'll go live to one of the women's marches around the country, the one in Albany. At 1 p.m., we'll have a live report on 90.7 FM. And at 8 p.m., jazz pianist Matthew Shipp performs from Roulette in Brooklyn live on the radio at WGXC 90.7 FM.
WGXC underwriting support is provided by Art Omai, a sculpture and architecture park and international residency center in Ghent, New York. Open daily from dusk until dawn. Art Omai presents the work of contemporary artists and architects across 120 acres of field and forest. Information at artomai.org.
WGXC is made possible in part by the generous ongoing support of Andrew Barwick of Brooklyn, New York. WGXC's sustaining supporters are among the station's most dedicated listeners. They care deeply about creative community radio, and their investment helps to sustain WGXC as a public platform for information, experimentation, and engagement in Greene and Columbia counties. You too can become a sustaining supporter by going to wgxc.org/donate and designating an amount of your choosing. Thank you for your support.
You are tuned to 90.7 FM, WGXC. Grabbable, handleable, listener-fueled radio for Greene and Columbia counties.
This is Tom Rowe with the WGXC News Update. Go to the WGXC Newsroom for more information about this story at wgxc.org. The latest uptick in coronavirus cases in the Upper Hudson Valley continued on October 16th. There were 10 new COVID-19 cases in Greene County, with 3% of those given tests coming back positive. After the Greene Correctional Facility, Catskill led the county with 7 current positive cases. There were also 5 new cases announced October 16th in Columbia County. Schenectady County reported 8 new COVID-19 cases. Albany County saw COVID-19 cases jump by 21, and health officials warned of a possible coronavirus exposure at O'Slattery's Irish Restaurant and Pub. In Rensselaer County, there were 5 new COVID-19 cases. Ulster County reported 2 new cases on October 16th. And while Dutchess County has 135 positive cases right now, Dutchess County Executive Mark Molinaro said October 16th that recent COVID clusters at Marist College in Poughkeepsie and the Hedgewood Home for Adults in Beacon are both, quote, progressing in the right direction, unquote. It is universally recognized among scientists and health officials that wearing a mask is the single best way to stop the spread of the virus, and that means when seeing family or friends, not just when going to the grocery store.
German measles, Russian flu, Montezuma's revenge. And why do we say a foreign word whenever someone sneezes?
Tomorrow, I'll take a look at swine flu, up close and personal. This is Les Nesbitt.
The infection election, from poll bearers to poll watchers. I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now! With Dennis Moynihan in our weekly Breaking the Sound Barrier podcast. On July 8th, Mark Anthony Urquiza, with his sons as pallbearers, was carried to his final resting place in Phoenix's Holy Cross Cemetery. He died of COVID-19 complications, on a ventilator, alone, but for a health care worker holding his hand. Urquiza's passing might have gone with scant notice, like far too many of the more than 217,000 people in the United States who've succumbed to this deadly disease so far, had his daughter, Kristen, not penned an obituary that garnered national attention. His death is due to the carelessness of the politicians, Kristen wrote, who continue to jeopardize the health of brown bodies through a clear lack of leadership, refusal to acknowledge the severity of this crisis, and inability and unwillingness to give clear and decisive direction, she said. Kristen Urquiza places the blame for her father's untimely death squarely with President Donald Trump.
My dad was a healthy 65-year-old.
Kristen spoke at the Democratic convention this summer.
His only pre-existing condition was trusting Donald Trump, and for that, he paid with his life.
Trump's calamitous pandemic response has cast a pall of death and economic calamity over the country as he inflames racism and division in the lead-up to this infection election. After 9 months of downplaying and outright lying about the pandemic, the White House, perhaps now better called the Blight House, is a COVID-19 hotspot itself. On Wednesday, we learned that Trump's teenage son, Barron, tested positive for the virus. Less than 3 weeks ago, the indoor reception and packed Rose Garden ceremony for Amy Coney Barrett's Supreme Court nomination, with no social distancing and very few masks, created a likely super spreader event. At least 40 people who were there or otherwise close to Trump have since tested positive. Trump, after being hospitalized, returned to the White House, ignoring CDC standards and medical norms, dramatically removed his mask and walked inside, potentially infecting staff and others. Days later, he held a rally on the South Lawn, with many of those attending not wearing masks closely packed in. From Florida to Pennsylvania to Iowa, maskless crowds have gathered at Trump rallies, where Trump claims he's now immune to COVID-19 and not contagious, providing no medical evidence. Trump is also actively promoting a dangerous herd immunity response to the pandemic, risking millions of deaths. Meanwhile, infections and hospitalizations are surging as the long-predicted autumn COVID-19 wave strikes, with close to 60,000 new cases reported Wednesday in the U.S. Intensive care units from North Dakota to Wisconsin to Mississippi are at or near capacity. The pandemic has caused the worst economic recession since the Great Depression. Many tens of millions are out of work. Many face eviction because they can't pay their rent. Yet Trump and the Republican-controlled Senate continue to stonewall federal COVID-19 relief. Instead, they're attempting to ram through the confirmation of Amy Coney Barrett to the Supreme Court. The hearings have revealed some of Barrett's disturbing legal views, including her belief that the right to bear arms is inviolable, but the right to vote is not. She refused to answer questions about the Affordable Care Act, Roe v. Wade, voting rights, or even if President Trump could delay the election or refuse to transfer power peacefully. Republicans are aggressively attempting to suppress Democratic votes. One of Trump's sons, Donald Jr., has called for volunteers to join an army for Trump's election security at Democratic precincts to challenge the right of individuals to cast their vote, to question the signatures on mail-in ballots, and otherwise intimidate and discourage voters. In Pennsylvania, a judge ruled the Trump campaign's deployment of so-called poll watchers in Philadelphia violated state law. Guns Down America reports that in the swing states of Michigan, North Carolina, Pennsylvania, Virginia, and Wisconsin, quote, the threat of armed individuals disrupting polling places is not theoretical. Private citizens with firearms have demonstrated at polling places during the 2016 and 2018 elections and are poised to do so again this November, they wrote. In Texas, Governor Greg Abbott limited each county to just one ballot drop location, regardless of county population. Thus, Harris County, including Houston, with over 4.7 million residents, gets as many ballot drop locations as Loving County's 169 residents. Ohio's Republican Secretary of State Frank LaRose similarly ordered just one ballot drop location per county, regardless of population. The intent is clear. Make it hard to vote in cities which tend to vote Democratic. Despite the obstacles, the threat of thugs at polling places and the looming tsunami of lawsuits promised by Trump and the Republicans, over 14 million people have already voted early, shattering previous records. Many are risking exposure to COVID-19, enduring lines that can take over 10 hours to cast their vote. During this infection election, voting is a vaccination for our ailing body politic. Mass participation just might be a miracle cure. I'm Amy Goodman with Dennis Moynihan.
One speeding ticket, Columbia County.
Columbia County, everybody gets speeding tickets. How else do they pay for the roads to get plowed in the winter?
Your forecast for the weekend. Well, on Saturday, partly sunny, then gradually becoming sunny with a temperature high near 56 degrees. Mostly clear Saturday night with a temperature low of around 35. And on Sunday, mostly sunny with a high near 59 degrees. Sunday night, mostly cloudy with a low of around 44. And that is your weather update from WGXC. 90.7 FM, radio for open ears in Greene and Columbia counties.
We're talking with Mary Panzetta and Nisha Velez Gallum about the Saturday, October 17th, Women's March socially distanced demonstration, one of many taking place around the country. And this one locally will be at 1 p.m. at the corner of Central Avenue and Roof Road in Colony. So I understand this is actually just going to be one of perhaps hundreds of demonstrations taking place. Why are people organizing this demonstration?
Well, and actually I'll tell you, it's Saturday the 17th, not the 7th. So just wanted to say that, Mark. The date of this is kind of to have symmetry. The first Women's March was the day after the inauguration, January of 2017. So what we're hoping is that this march will mark the end of this administration. The National Women's Organization has said, women will decide this election, defend its integrity, and fight together for the feminist future we need.
And what's gonna happen at the one in Albany?
So at the one in Albany, we'll be on the corner of Central Ave and Wolf Road, right in front of Colony Center. And this is just an invitation for anyone to bring a sign supporting a specific cause that they have or supporting a specific candidate that's on the ballot this year. And it's just a place for us to demonstrate that we want this to be the last march that we have to do to get him out of office or while he's in office. And so it's just a safe space for everyone to say, like, we support all of these causes, and these are basic human rights that people should have that they aren't having right now.
I remember going to the, I guess, the first Women's March right after the inauguration in New York City, and it was massive, hundreds of thousands of people, and I believe there were several others that took place after that. What has sort of the Women's March been doing over the last, 4 years, and what are some of the key issues you're hoping to highlight with this protest?
Well, there's been a Women's March every January since the first one. I also attended the one in DC, and really it was a life-changing event. I never was part of something so beautiful, so many people peacefully protesting. I think they claimed there was not one arrest in the ones that took place in the major cities, DC, New York, LA. So we have still kept a close watch on what this administration has been doing. And of course, most of what they've been doing is awful. So there's so, and to end it with this ramming of the justice, a selection of a Supreme Court justice against the wishes of Ruth Bader Ginsburg, being the hypocrisy of not allowing Obama to pick the last Supreme Court justice when it was months away from an election. So much of this is, one of the main things we protest is waiting to choose a Supreme Court justice until after the inauguration. And right behind that, the things that this court, may actually overturn, things like the ACA, protection for women's reproductive rights, ending marriage equality, on and on.
Now, I notice on the list of the issues, the last one, at least on the list I have, is ensuring the peaceful transfer of power, which will end Trump's reign of corruption and incompetence. Certainly, there's a lot of concern, that, especially with all the voting by mail, that it's certainly possible that, you know, Trump will be kind of ahead on election night and then, you know, falling behind once all the votes are starting to be counted by mail. You know, what do we do if Mr. Trump refuses to give up power? What is the Women's March role going to play?
Well, there are actually coalitions that are in existence right now. And they have a system where essentially people are creating these coalitions and these teams. And the day after election, November 4th, at around like mid-afternoon, they'll basically be deciding if they're going to click go, and all of these coalitions are going to be having protests wherever like they registered their location at. So there are, that's like a different program, but there are programs that are existing and different systems that are in existence right now to basically protect and respect the vote and make sure that our democracy is respected and he doesn't go forward, you know, stating that he won when not every single vote is counted.
Now, there certainly seems to be consensus among most people, liberal, left, moderate, with common sense, that Mr. Trump needs to depart. But there's also people who feel that a lot of issues like climate change and health care, let's just say right now the Democratic ticket is not the most progressive in the world. Is the Women's March thinking about, you know, what do they do to, you know, try to push the Democrats if the Democrats are able to, you know, win power this November?
Yes, many progressive groups formed after the election of Donald Trump. And we, you know, and I'm a co-facilitator of one of them, the Coalition of Capital Region Progressives. And we're not going anywhere. If we are able to turn presidency Congress blue, then Women's March being one of this, then our next step is to help our leaders with a more progressive agenda.
So what are you encouraging, you know, people to bring to this event on Saturday, October 17th? You know, signs, hats, banners, songs. What can people contribute to this particular event?
Mm-hmm. That's a great question. Well, the first thing is a mask. And the second thing would be whatever makes you like, whatever gives you power, whatever you are passionate about, create a sign. Spend, even if it's on a tiny piece of paper, hold it with your whole, like with everything that you've got in you. Use your power and use your voice. Bring your sign with you supporting a specific candidate if you're really passionate about them, supporting reproductive rights, LGBTQ plus rights, civil rights, whatever it may be.
And we will bring extra masks and hand sanitizer. We're really very COVID aware. So, you know, we'll be nudging people to stay 6 feet apart. We're really not going to have singing and chanting like you normally do at protests because, you know, that is a little more risky during COVID. So this may be a little bit more of a silent protest, but nonetheless, we hope there's a great visual.
And I understand that this, besides you mentioned earlier, the Coalition of Capital Region Progressives, that there's students from SUNY Albany are also involved in helping to put this together. You know, can you talk a little bit about, you know, what is the state of, you know, youth activism on campus, particularly after, you know, returning from the COVID shutdown?
Mm-hmm. Activism on campus, I feel like, is more stronger than ever. About 2 weeks ago, there was a protest on campus for Black Lives. A couple of days ago, there was a protest for Black Women Matter. And so students are very empowered to use their voice and use their numbers to, whether it is walk on campus or walk around Albany, to just say that they have a voice. And even if it's one person, more people are going to come out and join them, because we do live in Albany. We are a moderately liberal city. So, we are supported. We support one another. And the university does a good job at making sure we use our freedom of speech and follow COVID-19 guidelines. So, like I said, it has been very prominent this month, especially.
So we've been talking with Mary Panzetta and Nysha Velez-Gallen about the Women's March Socially Distanced Demonstration this Saturday at October 17th at 1 p.m. corner of Central Avenue and Wolf Road, womensmarch.com. Any final word?
We would love to line the street up and down Central Avenue and Wolf Road. Please come out, rain or shine.
Thank you very much. And this has been Mark Dunley for the Hudson Mohawk Radio Network.
90.7 FM. And now on the phone, we have Hannah Otten, the co-manager of the Catskill Micro Farm and new Catskill Food Pantry. They have a fall harvest gathering fundraiser this Saturday, October 17th. Hannah, are you there?
I'm here. Good morning.
Good morning. How has farming been this season?
It's been incredible, Tom, an absolute joy to get this project going. So I am one of the organizers with the Catskill Community Micro Farm, and our primary community partner this year has been the Catskill Food Pantry. So I'm not an organizer with them, but working closely with Megan Henry and Elliot Matteos and Alan Boonville for that project. And I'm happy to tell you all about our event this upcoming Saturday on October 17th and a little bit about what each project is here to do in Greene County.
Yeah, and they're both new projects that started this year, is that right or not?
Yep, both founded in 2020. The Catskill Food Pantry got going in March 2020, and the micro farm got going in May 2020.
And were they planned before the pandemic, or are they a response to the pandemic?
Well, the issues of food insecurity, and in particular nutrition insecurity in Greene County, have been going on for a long time prior to the pandemic, and probably post-pandemic, there's still going to be insufficiencies throughout the area, and we are working to address it. But yes, the pandemic kind of gave the spark, particularly for the micro farm, gave the spark for this project to get off the ground. The food pantry may have had longer time to come to fruition. I'm not particularly sure about that, but I think the pandemic really brought to our faces we need to address the food insecurities in this incredibly uncertain time. And with it being a global pandemic, and it was also interesting to be in New York State when we were with the city being a global epicenter for a sustained period, that like people need to be able to be as healthy as possible right now. It's very hard to do so when you aren't able to meet all of your nutritional needs. Food pantries are amazing, but unfortunately, they kind of rely on a model of packaged items, shelf-stable items, which aren't necessarily the healthiest option for everyone if you're relying on those for meeting all of your food needs and your family's food needs. Getting produce into that model was something that the micro farms saw as being able to fill a void in the nutrition gap. And so that's how our project really got off the ground. And we were just so lucky to partner up with the Catskill Food Pantry from the get-go.
Yeah, so if there wasn't a pandemic this year, there would still be food issues locally. Certainly in Catskill, rents are a big issue, and they're taking a lot of money out of people's food budgets.
Those
pressures, those economic pressures, were going on before the pandemic and only sort of seemed to be heightened by the pandemic.
Yes, unfortunately, that is appearing to be the case. And the thing about food insecurity is it can strike anyone at any moment. We found all of us were finding ourselves with our job prospects going, what, drying up or having to be postponed or whatever. So even if you've been able to afford your living expenses and your heating and cooling bills and your food, everything, suddenly that all got cut down, and people who never thought they'd be facing food insecurity are facing it in our area. And I grew up in between Columbia and Greene counties. I've seen this issue around me for my entire life. So it's been going on a while, even before this heightened rent and particular housing expenses going up, but it's been magnified by that. I would definitely hazard a guess. The pandemic helped to kind of be the spark to get these projects going. We've just received so much community support to keep it going that both projects are looking to expand operations next year. And that's why we're having this event on Saturday. And the event is our fall harvest gathering that's going to take place at the Micro Farm site, which is 105 William Street, from 1 to 4 o'clock. And it's an opportunity for members of our community to come see the Micro Farm site, see what our operations look like there, and to meet the organizers of the Catskill Food Pantry as well, be able to ask any questions you want, be able to inquire about volunteering opportunities if you feel drawn to join one or both of these initiatives in whichever way you can. There will be there'll be some music, there'll be some food items donated wonderfully by the Mermaid Cafe. Thank you so much, Michelle Williams, for doing that for this event. It's an entirely free of charge event as well. And like I said, from 1 till 4 o'clock, 105 William Street.
And who's playing the music?
I believe that Elliot, who's one of the organizers of the Catskill Food Pantry, is going to be DJing that, and he's a professional DJ, so it's going to be good stuff, and there'll be some kids' activities as well. Social distancing will be monitored and enforced, that we're not causing one another to become ill. That's very crucial. Wearing masks will also be mandatory, and we will have hand sanitizing, hand washing stations. We'll also have masks available in case one is forgotten or it gets messy. We'll be making sure that everybody stays healthy and safe but gets to learn about these projects.
And how did the micro farm go this first year? Was there anything you were surprised about, or was this a particular good growing season for tomatoes or something?
Yeah, definitely. I've been completely blown away by what we produced this year, and that's all down to our fantastic volunteers who showed up, kept showing up even when people started going back to work, and their time to volunteer shrank down. They still kept showing up to make it a success. So we started in May, which is a little bit late to get farming off the ground for the growing season. By June 24th, we had started harvesting some of our microgreens, and I think even there might have been some kale plants that were ready to be harvested. And as of October, as of this month, we've been able to donate over 1,000 pounds of fresh produce to the Catskill Food Pantry, which is kind of crazy if you see the site. We have a slightly under 1 acre sized lot that has been generously donated to us for use by the St. Patrick's Church. And we're using only a small corner of it because this was an entirely volunteer and donation-based initiative. We didn't have funding to kind of get it off the ground in a big scale. So we're starting with what we can do and growing from there. And yeah, from this one